Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow, to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.
Support for Pivot comes from ServiceNow. By now, you've probably heard about AI. You might even be sick of hearing about it. But despite all the hype, it's not always clear how AI can help your business. ServiceNow has some ideas. With their intelligent platform, they can put AI to work across your company, improving customer experiences, helping non-coders code, accelerating your IT team's productivity, and resolving HR cases faster. So work can actually work better for everyone. So stop the hype and start putting AI to work. Go to servicenow.com/genAI to see why the world works with ServiceNow.
Hi, everyone. This is Pivot from New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Kara Swisher.
And I'm Scott Galloway.
Oh, you're very slow today. You're low.
A little slow.
You weren't on Bill Maher this weekend, were you?
Go on.
Is he having you back? He hasn't invited me.
No, I didn't even get so much as a, hey, thanks, pal. I didn't get anything.
Yeah, not a box of flowers.
William. I thought he'd want to like grab Mexican food the next time he's in New York. I imagine we were going to become friends. Maybe he's just
holding
back.
You needed to stick with Ando. I'm sorry. Anderson Cooper really is your true one.
What Ando and I have is hard to replicate.
I would like that to come. You bring Ando onto the show. That's why I want to see what you would do.
So our friendship is so precious. I don't like to lean on for these types of things.
Speaking of precious, Elon Musk is sparring with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah,
and
that's
internet
really
bros
precious.
Have never been at greater odds. In one corner, Bernie Sanders used Elon Musk's outsized wealth, along with Jeff Bezos and others, to highlight wealth inequality in the U.S., which is pretty easy to do for Mr. Senator Sanders. On the other hand, Elon Musk said he's using his fortune for good, that he's going to bring it to move us to other planets. That's what he's spending his money, honestly. Okay. And then the bros went, nice
first
job,
he's
going to
invest in edibles. Anyways, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kara. What do you think?
I think it's ridiculous. Bernie Sanders is making a very good point. And he is like, no, my money will be used for good. He's like, what is he, Andrew Carnegie? And he's giving everybody a library.
He's right. Mm-hmm. He's right. Elon Musk has added the GDP of Hungary. He's going to peace out and move to Texas so he doesn't have to pay state income taxes, which he's been an enormous beneficiary of. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't. Capitalism is just not about having someone worth $170 billion and paying the lowest tax rate. But here's the problem. I believe Senators Sanders and
Warren.
Senators Warren are inspiring, and I think they're right, and I think they are totally ineffective.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing, Senator Sanders, is you jones for any camera or mic and make these indignant speeches about income inequality, you've been senator while we Democrats controlled all three houses, and you weren't able to get minimum wage up beyond $7.25.
Yeah.
While you are right that in the 60s, billionaires paid, or the top 1% paid an average of 60% of taxes, and then the 80s went to 40%, 3 or 4 years ago, it became common knowledge that billionaires now pay the lowest tax rate. And who is in the Senate? Senator Sanders and Warren. So I'm kind of, you're right. You're right.
Well, they have been going on for a while about it. They weren't in power to be able to do anything about it before, really.
Okay. I don't know. The Republicans always seem to be in power to hold back change.
Yeah.
We controlled, while they were senators, we controlled all three houses. And they like these big, bold jonesing for the camera and the lights ideas. Let's make college
jonesing
free.
Jonesing is your new word today, jonesing.
Let's make college free. That's not going to happen. And any sophomoric analysis leads to a basic conclusion that the majority of people in college are middle or upper income. So that is nothing but a transfer of wealth from poor households that never apply to college to people in college. Let's cancel all student
debt. What would be effective then for Bernie Sanders
to
do?
What would be effective?
Because you call attention to this GDP of Hungary thing you say all the time, which I do too.
Eliminate capital gains tax deduction. Just eliminate it. Why is Elon Musk paying 22.8%, but a person working on the factory floor at Tesla is paying 34%?
Regular income,
You know what's effective is Senator Michael Bennet, who is terrible at jonesing for the cameras.
Jonesing again,
The J word. But meanwhile, for the last 5 years, he has been behind the scenes pushing for earned income tax credit for children, mm-hmm. saying for $40 billion, not $4 trillion, we can take 40 to 60% of child poverty and eliminate it.
Yeah, effective.
And it, all that hard work and good
effective.
Legislation
yeah.
is resulted in a bailout bill that is the least, or the bailout package, the most recent one, is the least bad of its kind because almost half of it is going to people versus just only 50, 60 or 70% going to fucking Delta or some restaurant mm-hmm. that we make a cartoon over.
Yeah.
He's effective. You know who's effective? Yeah. Senator Amy Klobuchar,
yeah.
who's doing the work around antitrust. You know who's effective? Representative Cicilline, who spends less time jonesing for the fucking camera.
Of which, let me just switch to Representative David Cicilline, who runs the House Judiciary Committee's antitrust panel, says he and fellow Democrats are preparing a bombard big tech with a series of small antitrust lawsuits through May.
Little
just
attacks.
So they don't have to do this big honking one. What do you think of this strategy?
So,
Perry Mason, what do you think, Perry Mason?
I think it makes a lot of sense. What they're trying to do is they're trying to atomize the defense, and mm-hmm. that is they're saying, okay, if we have one big effort
yeah,
and we let killed. This massive army known as the lobbyists, the PR spin machine, the yeah. billions of dollars, the legal, every spare lawyer in America that will jones up or line up, I'm sorry, I'm going to use Jones again, that will line up behind Facebook,
yeah.
will line up behind the Facebook and Google and big tech yeah. army. They've decided it's going to be better to try and do an assault from the air, from the sea, and from the land.
Though
and
a
we'll
lot
go
of
after different
small
parts.
Ones.
What
yeah,
do you think?
I think it's a great idea. Actually, I hadn't even thought about it. Yeah, because these things, like the wheels go slowly. You know, it's like they move very slowly. And this is kind of an interesting strategy. I like it. I like the strategy. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going to have to consult with some lawyers. But I do think that it makes sense to try to get things done more quickly and more strategically, just like you were talking about with Michael Bennett. Like there's a lot of like big talk that never happens.
But that's exactly the point, is Representatives Cicilline and Senators Bennett and Klobuchar have decided, you know what? It's more important that we have a better America than I get my name in fucking lights all the
yeah.
time.
Yeah. I'm reading her book. I read her book this weekend, Antitrust. It's very big. It's very thick.
She's fantastic.
Senator she is. Klobuchar I'm talking to her this week. I'm talking to her after the hearings for Sway. I think it'll be really good. I think she's really.
That's a shocker.
She's a really.
That's a shocker. Someone I admire and constantly build up and highlight her effectiveness.
She
wants
to talk for an hour about antitrust. Yeah. We're talking about her giant book that could kill a poodle.
Oh, but we're bringing your brother on.
I gotta get you. What do you, who do you want? Who do you want? Who do you want?
I get such sloppy slack in seconds.
No, you
in this
do not get sloppy. Are you kidding? This show is killing it. I will find you a good name. You were supposed to bring on Ando. I bring on everybody. You could bring
on. I will bring on Ando. We're spending so much time together recently that we're a little bit sick of each other.
It's springtime. It's summer. You're getting ready for your summer.
We have spent no. By the way, I just feel like I need to disclose this. We have absolutely no relationship outside of CNN.
None. I'm going to get Ando to come on. I'm going to like pummel him on the Twitter and say, Scott says you're his friend and you're jonesing to come on to the show.
I'm intimidated by him. I don't think I could handle that.
I'm getting him to come on. He'll be funny. He'll do his little cute laugh. It'll be great. It'll be fantastic. Listen. I want to talk to you about Florida, though. Florida man, Miami.
God.
What the hell is going? What is wrong with Florida? Like they're facing new emergency lockdowns to help stop the spread of COVID-19 as flocks head to Miami Beach for spring. Like what in the living hell was going on down there? I'd never seen anything like it. And
well,
I thought last year was bad.
It's just a shocker. We have it in a state where people eat each other's faces. Old people bump into each other in their overly long cars from the 60s. We have alligators being eaten by African pythons released by pet owners that seem to only...
All I want to know about is Miami Beach.
I mean... Florida.
I read Edna Buchanan's book, The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. I am aware of the situation in Florida. But what? Where are the police? What happened? They had like gas these people. They had like little pepper bombs or whatever.
Look, people, there's so much pent up energy.
Yeah.
They feel like Florida. Look, words matter and actions matter. Mm-hmm. And I do think that a lot of the horrendous things that have happened in the news recently are a function of that. When our leaders don't take more resolute stands against mm-hmm. certain types of behavior or crime, it leads to bad places. And this is a smaller example of that. And that is, when Governor DeSantis wasn't aggressive about closing the beaches last year,
he wasn't.
When we've adopted this attitude of,
it's
sort of over, but it's not, and oh, look at us, where's our apology? Florida's definitely taken sort of a Trumpian stand on COVID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to their credit, some of the data supports what they've been evangelizing, but where it leads to is it leads to this notion that come to Florida where there's no COVID and behave irresponsibly.
Yeah.
So we kind of invited this. Our leadership invited this, and then you end up with mayors overwhelmed. They can't control.
DeSantis is popular, I believe.
DeSantis is popular. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is popular in Florida. We'll see. We'll see. Really Governors Cuomo. Can fall from grace really fast.
Yes, I noticed that with the Cuomo. Yeah, and the Newsom, they can go up and down.
But it's just, I find it really discouraging and upsetting because there's still a lot of people who are very vulnerable.
Yeah.
We're seeing 5% infection rates.
They're up again.
They're up again. I don't know. What do you think? I don't have a lot to say about this. I don't even know what to say.
If my child was there, I'd be furious at him. That's all. I was just thinking, where are the parents here, with these kids partying? The parents are like, what the hell? I'm so sick of this. It is sort of, but they did it last year. If they hadn't done it last year when things were bad, it's just, I don't know. I don't know what to say. The pictures are really bad. But, we'll see what happens, I guess, maybe.
Yeah.
It's YOLO. It's YOLO is what's happened, YOLO times 50. I don't think there's anything we can do at this point. I think everyone sort of had it with COVID. Done. Next.
Yeah, people are reaching. There's just no doubt about it. People are reaching the limits, which makes it even more important that everyone get a jab.
Yep, 100%. Okay, on to big stories. There's so many stories around, Scott, but this is a big story. This is a big story. Dispo, the once promising photo sharing app, it still is promising, it was quite high on the Apple App Store, is facing challenges after its founder, David Dobrik, faced allegations of sexual assault. It's actually allegations in the group that he wasn't accused of it.
It was someone in his group,
David,
right?
Had gained popularity on Vine and then on YouTube, has been facing allegations, the group around him. I forget what the name of the group is, but it's a little group around him that does things. They do sort of stunts and things like that, facing lots of different allegations, race. Now there's new racist stuff, anti-Asian stuff. They're just surfacing all the sort of antics that he did, which are all juvenile, and some of which are racist, a lot of which are sexist. And then, of course, behaviors by his gang around him. I think it's called the Vlog Gang or something like that. He started a photo sharing app also called Dispo, which had gained a lot of traction. But following these investigations of these sexual assaults and other issues, the app's rating dropped below 2 stars on Apple's App Store. The venture capital firm Spark Capital, which led the startup's $20 million Series A financing in February, announced it would sever all ties with Dispo, which means it's pretty bad. And then Dobrik said he's maybe stepping back from the company. Wow, this is a fast one. This is kind of a cool app, I actually have to say. He is sort of a funny character and super popular. And he's sort of in that, there's a whole gang of those YouTube people that have had problems, and he's the latest.
Yeah. So I've come to, my view is that media interprets things based, 49% of it is the content of what you say, and 51% is who says it. So you go first.
Well, okay. It's really interesting because it comes at the same time. There's this controversy around Teen Vogue and some racist tweets and homophobic tweets that Alexi McCommond, I think, at some point, she was made editor of Teen Vogue, and then they unmade her before she started. Mm-hmm. In that case, actually, Elizabeth Spears wrote, I think, the best piece about it. You immediately have to veer into this stupid cancel culture thing when, in fact, in this case, it's accountability. In the case of Dobrik. I mean, he just decided to be an asshole. It's sort of like the other guy on YouTube that was standing in front of all those dead bodies. And once again, I'm blanking on his name. And another YouTube star. But he did a lot of these things. And then there is controversy around Dispo, too, that he took the idea from someone. There was someone alleging that. Probably Spark Capital's I don't know, although it was gaining. It's a really interesting app where you take pictures and then they show up the next day in these disposable camera look, and teens really liked it. It's quite a creative photo app.
Attraction.
But you have to decide what's accountability and what's unfair. In the case of Alexi McCommon, it's very complicated. I think it's Anna Wintour is at fault for hiring her, someone who wasn't particularly, she didn't have any experience running a magazine, but she sort of has the buzz as a political reporter covering the Trump White House and this and that. She also got pulled into another scandal over at the White House, which I won't go into. But I think they just used the opportunity in this case to deal with it because Condé Nast is under such pressure around diversity issues, justifiably, and has had, from the Kamala Harris thing to previous people, books that have been written about it, about the company, including someone who was with her for a really long time, Anna Wintour, calling her a colonial dame, which was not very nice, but that's what he said. And so it's, you know, it's hard to take apart what's accountability. Before, you just used to get into trouble and then you'd leave. Now you call cancel culture out. And at the same time, what David Dobrik was doing was pretty icky. And I can't believe people invested in him in the first place, but, you know, they were looking for money. What do you think?
I think the two are totally different, and they both have lessons. And one's mm-hmm. a lesson for young people, and another, I think, is a cautionary tale for mm-hmm. all of us, and especially for parents. With respect to Dispo, look, and there's a lesson here. There's wonderful things about being an innovator and being yep. young and understanding technology. You get unfair or unwarranted idolatry. Mm-hmm. People think you're cooler than you are. You have the opportunity to make tens of millions of dollars by the time you're, you know, 25 or 30.
Right.
But boss, nothing's for free.
Yeah.
And one of the things you have to pay, or one of the things you have to do, is that you cannot in any way have your corporation or yourself personally, when you reach a certain level of seniority in an organization, mm-hmm. put yourself in a position to have credible accusations levied against you of this sort. And through due process, we'll find out hopefully what happened here and if there was a crime here, if it was just terribly poor judgment. But you don't, if you want to be a player in our capitalist society and grab its and appreciate its fruits and it's incredible spoils for innovators, mm-hmm. you can't put yourself in a stupid fucking position like this. You don't let this shit happen. You don't let three people in any way associated with your firm go into a room to have sex when they're drunk.
This is called the vlog squad, just so people
don't
know.
You're setting yourself up to get tagged.
He's 24 years old.
Yeah, but if a 24-year-old is old enough to make millions of dollars or raise $20 million, then he needs to be old enough to go.
I'm not giving him the age excuse. I'm just saying what happened is these allegations happened, and then everyone's sort of reassessing his previous work.
And this is where it
vlogging
goes.
And these stunts now, that he did.
The media mob takes it. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there was another incident. One of their posse mm-hmm. was pranked. They dressed up a guy as a woman. They convince him to kiss her, and then post his embarrassment, he has categorized this as a sexual assault. So now the media is saying that Dispo and these individuals are associated with multiple, plural, sexual mm-hmm. assaults. Is that fair? Maybe, maybe not. But when you're the CEO of a company, when you're the principal of a company, nothing's for free. And if you want the opportunity to make tens of millions of dollars at a young age, it means, boss, you got to be clean as a fucking whistle.
But who
and you
got
to be the
who
adult
is?
In the room. And I remember when I first started my company, my first firm, Profit, we used to go to Mexico every year. Everyone would get ridiculously fucked up. And I've decided in today's age, I wouldn't do that. I just wouldn't want to put the firm and people's economic livelihoods at risk. Mm-hmm. So this is just capitalism. And Spark is doing the right thing. They're like, look, we just can't be associated with this.
Well, should they have checked it before? How much due diligence can you do? Like, and then talk about the Alexei McCormick thing. Like, what do you...
Well, that's the right question. Now, in terms of Condé Nast, I think this is frightening. And let's come up with a different word for cancel culture, because now cancel culture is being thrown back in our faces and say, no, it's just an excuse for people that don't want to be held accountable. Right. When you are 17, mm-hmm. I mean, everyone who hasn't done something stupid or said something stupid and offensive at the age of 17, raise your hand, all right? Yeah. And way to go for you. But the majority of us have, but we didn't live in an era where there was a hot mic following us around our entire lives. And the notion that we are now the woke mob, I don't know, to a certain extent, Condé Nast was put in a terrible position, because actually I think the thing that caused it was Anna Wintour initially supported her, but then the advertisers started withdrawing from Teen Vogue. And at what point, okay, just keep in mind, folks, and there's an entire generation of people, and I've been trying to more cognizant of my behavior, that online have decided they have a certain standard of purity, which, by the way, they have no intention of upholding personally.
Yep.
And okay, just be clear, this mentality, this lack of forgiveness, is coming for your children. And guess what? If she had committed manslaughter and gone to jail for 2 or 3 years and then been released from prison and gone on to be a reporter for Axios and gone on to become appointed for Teen Vogue, the woke mob would have found that an inspiring story of renewal. the Statute of Limitations.
Woke mob. This is Condé Nast. I'm going to put it right on Condé
Nast. But it was the woke mob that came after the advertisers.
They would do, they didn't care about, they care. This happens a million times with advertisers. This is the Condé Nast. Let's put the blame where it belongs, which is on Condé Nast management and directly on Anna Wintour. I'm sorry. That's where it is. She hired her and then, got spooked and decided not to do it by these advertiser things. That's where it is. And this advertiser pressure happens all the time. This is not a new and fresh thing for different people.
Okay, so I think Condé Nast should have said, I think they should have stuck with her.
Yeah.
But there's a bigger point here, though, and that is we shouldn't try children as adults.
That is a completely fair thing. I don't think that had anything to do with it. I thought that they decided they made a mistake in hiring someone without any actual
in New York,
experience.
If you commit manslaughter, and they can't find enough evidence against you, there's a statute of limitations for 5 years. But racist tweets don't have a statute of limitations.
Then people that insulted her, they did tweets that were problematic too. The people that were sort of putting it on. I'm still going to place it directly on Condé Nast and Anna Wintour. Either stick with her or they could care less about the staff and what they think. They care about the advertisers, and then they can't take another.
Well,
they have previously had so many racially based incidents, that's what they're throwing this woman under the bus for their own problems. That's my feeling.
I get it. You're going very tactical to the situation. This represents a more serious disease in our society. And it is out of control when we decide to take notes and go back and start fucking up people's lives and livelihoods because of stupid things they did at the age of 17.
I think, true. But in this case, I think there's a whole lot more going on here than that. And I think it's Condé Nast. Condé Nast has suffered from things they deservedly have been criticized for, and they don't want to take another one. So they're going to toss this woman out the door before she got there. I think that's where it begins and ends. Anna Wintour can't make one more mistake. So instead of stepping aside herself, she pulls someone else down. We're not going to disagree.
Well, come on. She wasn't going to step aside.
No, but she had the Kamala Harris cover before. That like there were dozens of
the Kamala Harris cover. I wouldn't describe that.
I know
as
that, but I'm saying it just
racism.
Was like that was the most recent one. There were like dozens and dozens of things at Condé Nast.
This isn't a Condé Nast problem. It's a societal problem.
I don't think so. I think Condé Nast is like just they had misbehaved before, and this woman's paying for it. But I don't think they care anything about what their staff thinks. I really don't. I don't think they seem to have done that in general, and they throw their staff under the bus all the time. And that's what they did here. Let me just say the person who had the problem before David Dobrik is Logan Paul. Who he took the video in the Japanese suicide forest, and then YouTube dealt with him. Anyway, this is not a new thing. That behavior, you absolutely should be thrown off for. And then David Dobrik, absolutely. I feel like that's perfectly fine. Anyway, Scott, we're going to go on a quick break. We'll be back to talk about Trump's new social media platform and a friend of Pivot on NFTs.
Support for Pivot comes from the Optimistic Outlook podcast. What can a microgrid on Chicago's South Side teach us about the future of energy? How can we fight to make clean air a basic human right? And why are there almost a million open manufacturing jobs right now? There's only a few people in the world with the expertise, access, and perspective to give real answers to those questions. And Barbara Humpton, the CEO of Siemens USA, is one of them. On her podcast, The Optimistic Outlook, you get a seat at the table with Barbara as she shares the latest insights on breakthroughs in manufacturing technologies that are reshaping our reality. Barbara's guests include thought leaders, industry mavericks, and researchers who all share actionable information and ideas about the technologies that are creating our future. Recent episodes highlight how new technology paired with sustainability efforts has radically changed workplaces across the spectrum, from hospitals and energy plants to transportation systems. Other fascinating topics include sustainable beer brewing, the power of 3D printing, and the incredible potential of self-healing concrete. To learn more, join the dozens and dozens of people who tune into this podcast. Listen to The Optimistic Outlook wherever you consume your podcasts.
Support for Pivot comes from Fundrise. You know the adage, buy low, sell high. It's easy to say and hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/pivot. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Okay, we're back. And so is former President Donald Trump. Apparently, he'll be returning to social media, this time with his own social network. This weekend, longtime Trump advisor Jason Miller told Fox News that Trump will be, quote, returning to social media probably in the next 2 to 3 months on his own platform that will attract, apparently, tens of millions of new users and, quote, completely redefine the game. Reminder, Trump was permanently banned from Twitter after inciting riots at the Capitol in January. Scott, he might or might not be off of Facebook. That's going to be TBD. What do you think, Scott?
Look, I think greatness is in the agency of others, and Donald Trump built a brand sort of the greatness is in the agency of PR and self-promotion and mm-hmm. then calling on our kind of worst instincts, I think. Mm-hmm. And the reputation that Donald Trump and the Trump Organization has always had is that they're terrible operators.
Yep.
Where they make money is by taking their brand and making it famous, whatever it's famous for, and then licensing it. But they're not. Yep. And like building technology, unless somebody, if he were to say, I've partnered with Friendster, or I've mm-hmm. got a team of 200 engineers lined up, then maybe. But this stuff is difficult. He's not an operator.
No.
Anyways, I would not go long this. What do you think?
I think it's ridiculous. I think beyond that, if they can't do it, they can't do it is my number one thing, is that he won't do it. It's like Trump's stakes would be an easier lift for this guy.
Right.
And that failed, and Trump water, all of them. He's trying to put his name on these things. And also social networks really are network effects. And that means everybody's there. And the reason he was popular on Twitter is because not just his fans were there, but all the politicians, all the media, all the detractors, all the bots.
You need all of it. They were just as important. Yeah.
I'm not joining the Trump network just to listen to him. I didn't join Parler, right? I know what's on it. So he would be better off like, helping revive Parler again or something like that. Maybe he is. Maybe that's
my guess is he ends up on Clubhouse.
Yeah, that's where he should go, don't you think? Just go to Clubhouse 100%. And take it over. Take over a section 100%. Of it. Take over one that he hasn't shit all over and stay there until he shits all over it and they kick him off, really. I think that's what he should do. Why wouldn't he? I think this is destined for failure. It just doesn't have everybody. Everyone's not at the party, and these social networks need everybody at the party. And then other thing is, you know, everyone was talking about Twitter, and I'd love your comment on this, going down after Trump left. Well, it's up $20 since he left office, $25.
Down?
Yeah. Everyone said, oh, he's not going to be on it. It's going to hurt Twitter's business.
Yeah, if management and the board had more of a backbone and their words foot to their actions, and they actually gave a good goddamn about the Commonwealth. There's a movement to purity here. Their immunities are kicking in. There's a citizen effect taking place, and that is Snap mm-hmm. and Pinterest have been more vigilant about trying to keep their mm-hmm. platforms less toxic. And guess what? They have appreciated faster over the last 18 months.
That's right.
Twitter's move to purity here it has resulted in a massive accretion in shareholder value, plus some threatening the subscription also. There's some very hopeful things here. The companies are being rewarded. Public, and again, I'm an investor. Public is the immunity to Robinhood. And guess what? It went from $100 million valuation to $1.2 billion. There is a citizen accretive effect here that is very healthy. And you can do well by doing good. And Twitter's just starting to figure out that being, again, a handmade sedition was not a good business strategy.
And neither is anything Donald Trump does that requires execution. And this requires a lot of execution. It's all so much bullshit. And they won't. And by the way, you don't see them leaving Twitter either. So they stay. That's where politicians are. Okay, next up, friend of Pivot. Here to clarify all things cryptocurrency and NFT, we have Scott's colleague, chairman of the Department of Finance at NYU Stern, David Yermak. David, thank you for, Professor Yermak, thank you for coming.
Thank you for the invitation.
No problem. So can you just give us an explanation? I've written about it recently and I had Beeple on today on my podcast, but give us a blanket explanation of how these NFTs work.
An NFT is a collectible, and
they reside on a blockchain, which means that they can't be replicated. And if you own one, you own the only one. Mm-hmm. And so the market for NFTs resembles the market for comic books, baseball cards, rare coins and stamps, all sorts of other things, where the intrinsic value of the object is really not so high, but the fact that you have the only one or one of a very small set is what confers the bragging rights and the prestige. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the scarcity is assured by cryptography, which arguably is something that would defeat counterfeiting and other ways of forging and replicating these assets. There's markets for art where sometimes you see forgeries of Rembrandts and so forth. With NFTs, those kinds of concerns go by the books because you don't have to worry about people replicating. The blockchain gives a degree of uniqueness and security that no other registry system ever has in history.
Right. So why are we suddenly hearing about them? And are they a fad? Because I think everybody's super, I was like, don't worry, it'll sort itself out. It's just a way to do transactions, essentially. But talk about why you're suddenly hearing about them and if you think they will go away. I don't, but go ahead.
No, I don't think they'll go away either. And we have had booms and busts in the collectibles markets. You may remember the big bubble in comic books around the year 2000 and so forth. But there have been markets in fine art for hundreds and hundreds of years. And there's a whole network of auction houses and galleries and appraisers that feed that market. And one of the enduring questions about why is a Rembrandt so valuable? Is it because it's so exquisite to look at that people get so much pleasure? Or is it simply the bragging rights, the prestige of being rich enough to be able to afford one? And I think NFTs answer that question very much on the side of the second argument, that you can brag that you have the only copy of Jack Dorsey's first tweet. Mm-hmm. And if it's authenticated by a blockchain, even though other people could replicate and look at the exact copy, so anyone could copy Beeple's file and have a perfect rendering of it, but there's only one first edition. And, you know, collecting is partly about pleasure and partly about money laundering and wealth storage and so forth, but it's really about showing off and bragging. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's driving the NFT market. And these are rather timeless human emotions that I think will always be with us.
Mm-hmm. Scott?
David, does the person who owns the asset or owns the IP, does that ownership transfer or have power in this new medium? Or does it make sense to just raise $100 million and start creating NFTs of every valuable piece of IP ever and claim that you own it?
We don't know the answer to that yet. And you're seeing people rushing supply onto the market. You know, just today, Time Magazine created three new covers that they were going to auction off in NFT form. Mm-hmm. And they did this simultaneously with the publication of a series of articles about NFTs. Now, will anyone bid for these? I'm not sure. I think in any kind of fad where asset pricing's are rising quickly, whether it's on Wall Street or a market like this, you will see more supply emerge to the point that the market becomes flooded and probably drops.
That's right.
But my question is, I'm sorry to interrupt you. My question is, what if Time put out NFTs for covers of National Geographic? Yeah, could National Geographic
say? I think National Geographic could sue them because they have a copyright. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you do have property rights for people who, could be held accountable in court who infringe on them. You have interesting questions of jurisdiction, like in what court would you bring such a case and under exactly what statute? But I think many of the laws that have been around for a long time that apply to ownership rights of intellectual property would transfer very easily to NFTs.
Right. Would they make them more ironclad, these copyright laws? I would think so, if you could transparently see who owns it and it's a very clear ownership path.
Yeah, certainly the proof that you can offer in court may be a lot simpler on a blockchain because you can show an uninterrupted chain of custody and so forth. There have been real disputes about who owns a certain painting or who owns the royalties to a piece of music that has been sold and resold through many hands. Often it's very difficult to tell, But the promise of a blockchain is to fix those rights very unambiguously. That clarifies the ownership and the property rights for sharing of royalties and profits in a much better way.
And then artists can continue to hold them, right? Because in some of these contracts, for example, with Beeple, he's going to be, if it sells again, he gets a portion of that. You can write anything into these smart contracts.
Yeah. In fact, it's a very popular proposal. And I think it's even mandatory in Europe mm-hmm. that an artist holds a residual royalty to resale. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit like having a call option on the value of your work
right.
that is perpetual. If the thing gets sold and resold at auction, there are 10% of the profits filtering back to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is an interesting contract. But on the other hand, if the artist is retaining that residual right, the work should sell for a lower price in the first instance, that you mm-hmm. know you're only getting 90% of the upside and Beeple is keeping 10%, so you should only pay 90 cents on the dollar. And to the extent that Beeple may think the market's overheated, Beeple would be better off selling the whole 100% instead of holding that residual option.
Right.
But who knows? This
right.
is,
you don't
this
know.
Is what makes a market. And if artists want to retain 10% or even 50% residual, It's something the technology very yes, easily
look at,
admits.
Look at Jeff Koons. He should have held on. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people, they
you
know,
it's
up.
It's very easy to look backward and yeah. identify people who should have hung on to their work. You know, Caravaggio right. should never have sold his supply until 400 years later. But if you look at all of the art that's correct, is being produced at a moment in time, most of it turns out to be worthless and has very little value in the
yep.
future. And the studies that tend to encourage these kinds of things don't take account of the very high failure rate.
Right.
And it can be very hard to tell in the moment that a canvas or a digital piece that you've just produced really will be popular in 50 or 100 years. But certainly for the ones where that turns out, yeah, you wish you had retained more of the value for yourself.
Yeah, 100%.
So let's try and project what might happen here. When you think of traditional IP film media, They don't pay to star in the movie, they pay to market it, right? And Voesfeld, art is the most successful artists are not only the best artists, artisans, they're the best marketers. And this feels like it's literally 99.9% your marketing acumen versus 0.0001 intrinsic value, right? Other than the scarcity component you talked about. Aren't the natural players here the ones that could really make bank? The social media platforms that could create their own marketplace and then promote and market the NFTs that they own and just kind of just make crazy bank?
I think that this is an interesting point. I'm not sure that they have the advantages and security that you get from the decentralized platforms.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things about the work of Beeple and many of the other popular NFTs is that they are on the Ethereum platform.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's really no gatekeeper and nobody who can censor or take down or change the rules, because it's a decentralized, essentially a self-enforcing set of algorithms that governs this. If you put it on Google, you're working for Larry and Sergey, or you know, Amazon, you're working for Jeff Bezos. And so I'm not sure that people in the end will trust the social media platforms to protect the integrity of the property rights, the same way that you see on the decentralized blockchains.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the lack of a so-called trusted third party or a gatekeeper is part of the value proposition of the NFT.
So what else could be made into NFTs? Like, it's not just someone I was talking to saying you can put a house on it, you can put other things. Does it have to be a collectible?
Well, I think you're making a more general point about fractional ownership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is what happened to the Beeples. The guy bought them, and now he's fractionalized the entire collection, and he's selling coins. I think these B20 coins.
Yeah. No, people have been talking for many years about applications like a young athlete who maybe is still in college
mm-hmm.
selling shares to their future contracts. You know, if you're an All-American football player about to enter the NFL draft, you could syndicate 15 years of future salaries and then, you know, share them out and get the money up front in a lump sum.
Mm-hmm.
You could invest, you know, in all kinds of types of human capital of new MBA students, maybe a portfolio of 100 MBAs coming out of the top business schools and get a stream of their royalties.
Wow.
There's really no limit to this, but there are also interesting incentive effects that the athlete who pre-sells their contract right obviously has less incentive to train and perform. You know, they don't bear the risk. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with a musician who pre-sells the royalties. If Taylor Swift could sell forward future albums, you know, maybe they're not going to be as of high quality. The songs won't be as well written and so forth. So there's very interesting incentive effects that I think will figure in this market in the future. And some of them are probably good. Some are probably bad. We're in a very early stage and don't fully understand these yet.
Yeah.
It's funny you say that because I don't think I would have ever written a book had someone not given me an advance and I felt like I had to. The other question, and you kind of leaned into this a bit, what if these are gold mines? Who's selling the picks in the denim tents? What technologies? You mentioned Ethereum, but who makes money here? What's the technology or the companies that benefit if there's a craze in NFTs?
You know, the people making money right now are the ones selling the mining hardware. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a very clear analog that in the old days it was picks and shovels and pans. Today, it's essentially specially designed computer chips and circuits that are programmed to mine cryptocurrency.
Yep.
And some of these companies are going public. So there are now crypto mining companies that are being listed on the stock exchange because it's a fast-growing revenue, very traditional business, really, just catering to the crypto markets. And there's all kinds of things like podcasts that are attracting viewers to listen to people talk about crypto and so forth. You know, a whole industry is circling the technology, if you will. And I think first and foremost, the hardware providers, but I'm teaching a university course and students are applying to go to NYU so that they can take this course. We're all benefiting from second order effects of people who are interested in this.
And that, of course, you have to locate, and it's a lot of the activities in China where they locate them next to energy grids and things like that, which is somewhat really interesting how this is all playing out. But what advice would you give for someone who's just looking on? Because when they see this NFTs, it sort of start, I think it's sort of a consumer gateway into cryptocurrency, what these NFTs are in a lot of ways. But what advice would you give for someone looking to invest in cryptocurrencies or NFTs, which I think NFTs is probably an easier way for them to do so?
You know, the timeless advice is to diversify. You know, unless you find some special skill that you can recognize digital art better than the next person, if you really feel that this needs to be in your portfolio, I would spread your money around and look for an overall rate of return and let the risks cancel themselves out rather than putting all your eggs in one basket.
Is there one area like art versus the tweets of Jack Dorsey versus the videos of sports stars and things like that?
Very hard to say. Again, you know, diversifying some of these things like the Super Bowl highlights, it's hard for me to see that anyone can really fix a claim on that.
Yeah.
But we've had, you know, baseball cards. I remember trading them in my youth, and I have a son now who is trading the NFT equivalent of sports cards. And, you know, I think I never put all of my allowance into baseball cards. And I wouldn't recommend that he puts all of his weekly meal money at college into the NFTs, but maybe 1 or 2%. And, you know, also own real estate and equities and bonds and everything else. But I think, you know, the market is small. It's a very volatile speculative market. And I think most of the returns that people get are likely to be by chance as opposed to by skill.
Yeah. But it does give cryptocurrency a little workout and something in the ways that it hasn't beyond a speculative instrument, essentially.
I don't know. The cryptos are growing very quickly, and many of them are specially designed to solve certain problems. The main value of Ethereum seems to be connections to decentralized finance or DeFi, which essentially takes the insurance and risk management industries and makes it run by robots without many of the moral hazard problems. That this is actually something very socially useful, but it's a rather subtle contribution that people don't really think too much about when they buy Ether. I think, you know, the blockchain is a platform that can host many of the markets that up until now have resided on very primitive types of ledgers. The double entry bookkeeping. We have a lecture by a colleague at NYU, Amy Whitaker, who comes in every term and looks at art gallery ledgers, which are literally recipe boxes filled with index cards, where you know, forgeries and missing cards and so forth have been huge problems that have led to litigation. And so the contribution here is better record keeping. And this can add value to all kinds of markets and human endeavors in medicine and the arts and, you know, and all kinds of things. And so I don't think it's really about speculation in the long run. It's about a very novel technology that has a lot of social utility.
Yep. Scott, last question.
Do you think that, David, when you look at it feels as if, okay, Bitcoin at $60,000, NFTs going for millions, it feels a lot of this is foam off the froth or froth off the foam of an economy that is just awash in cash. But there's also a notion that these technologies are decentralization, disruptive, and protecting us from, or a way to kind of escape from the traditional norms, dangers of our central bank-driven economy, whatever you want to call it. Do you think these assets are correlated? And if and when we see a correction in the market, you'll just see a lot of the air come out of the balloon here? Or do you think that they're actually inversely correlated?
Do you mean the crypto assets, the Bitcoins, the Ether, the NFTs?
Well, you tell me, but it feels like this whole genre or asset class somewhat trades together. And so far, it seems somewhat correlated to the larger economy. Bitcoin hit $5,000 when the market crashed last year. We all like to think it's not correlated, but it feels like everything's correlated right now. Do you think this larger space of crypto, NFTs, the hardware, do you think it becomes, is it inversely correlated or correlated to the general?
No, I think it's probably positively correlated, but I can tell you there's a lot of high level research among asset pricing experts beginning to look at this, and we'll be able to answer that better in maybe a year or two. But it's obviously important that the person who paid $69 million for the Beeple, they paid in Ether, they didn't pay in real money. And this was a person with a lot of Ether tokens that they had come into possession of by whatever means. And a lot of the ownership of art through history has been done, you know, because it's a store of value and it's a way to take a monetary instrument issued by a government and to transform it into something that is probably more permanent and enduring. And I think the person who bought the Beeple probably viewed it as less risky than a pile of Ether tokens.
Yep.
But on the other hand, if Ethereum collapses, I think the auction prices for NFT are probably going to go south too, because a lot of the clientele for this are people with crypto profits that are looking to park it somewhere a little bit safer.
And then do interesting financial instruments with them, which is what they're trying to do with it, at least in the case of Beeple. So I have a last question. If Pivot were to make an episode into an NFT, what would be your advice?
Oh, have me as the guest. Sell for billions, I'm sure. No, if you could get someone like, you know, Jack Dorsey or Satoshi Nakamoto to be the guest and then turn it into an NFT.
Oh, nice.
That's probably the one. Get Vitalik, the creator of Ethereum.
Yeah.
There's all kind of crypto celebrities who might lend their name, you know, on an experimental basis to a little test if you give them a 10% kickback of the royalties.
Scott was just going to say how important you are, correct? Scott, go right ahead.
Well, I was going to say this off mic, professor, but David is chair of the finance department at NYU, which makes him the most powerful person at Stern, because basically Stern, let's be honest, David, is the finance department in the Seven Dwarves. You guys roll your eyes every time the marketing department has anything to say. David's the most powerful person at NYU.
No comment, Scott.
He's rolling his eyes.
So, no, our dean would object to that, except he's also a finance.
He's a finance. Yeah, where did he come from? The finance department.
So let me just, people are getting very emotional about NFTs for some reason. I'm like, don't do them then. What would you say to the average person with NFTs? Just, it's fine. It's just another financial instrument. Just relax or beware.
It would really depend on what else they own. You know, the advice about what to do with an asset is always contingent on.
Well, they don't own it at all. They just feel offended.
10 other NFTs they should probably sell. But if they have $100 million in equity and they just came into this, you know, see what happens.
Yeah.
I have a 17-year-old daughter who's sitting downstairs right now, and she actually does digital art. She's been taking high school courses and so forth. And I told her to drop all the other classes, calculus and all the other, you know, chemistry, just do the digital art for the time being.
That's good parenting.
Good parenting. Good parenting. Good parenting. Yeah.
You know, she's skeptical. And I said, I want you to Google Beeple and figure out what this Beeple is doing.
Yeah.
And then do the same thing.
He's still making them. There's still.
So far, she's still working on her other courses. And this makes
Professor, diversify your financial, but not your human capital.
come on. I've got diversify. Kids and only one is a digital artist.
I say, I like it. I like how he thinks. Anyway,
that's your portfolio.
David Yermak is the chairman of the Department of Finance at NYU Stern. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, David.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, Scott, that was fascinating.
So, Kara, let me tell you something about Professor David Yermak.
Okay, I do know his name. He's very famous.
And he's one of the reasons, you know, I continue to want to like be affiliated with Stern and why it's so rewarding. Mm-hmm. That guy could make tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year working for a credit fund. Mm-hmm. And what he chooses to do is to try and figure out, do research and discover if there's a Michelle effect. And he tried to figure out the correlation between Michelle Obama's apparel and stock price movement. He then found the tail numbers of every jet of every CEO and determined that when they left for holiday, they planned to leave for holiday after the earnings call. That means that there was about to be an earnings beat. This guy is such a genius.
Right. That was famous. I remember that.
This guy is such a genius and so creative. And he's decided... My role.
I think he's a character on Billions. There's a character like that.
My role is to communicate that genius and that creativity to a new generation of finance people.
Yeah.
He is. Every time I speak to David, I learn something, and I think, okay, that's
like why an economic
NYU continues to be important.
I like. Don't insult marketing people. They're fine too. Don't.
We get literally no respect at Stern.
I know.
Literally.
Just so you know, speaking of NFTs, we need to take a quick break. But first, Jonathan Mann tweeted at us that he used my catchphrase, fatuous popinjay, which I use liberally among the people, mostly in the Trump administration, but many people are fatuous popinjays. Recently, it was Tucker Carlson. He turned it into a song with the intention to sell it and as an NFT. He's been writing a song a day for 13 years. He sold the first 365 songs as NFTs. They sold out in 30 minutes. Let's play it. Fatuous Poppin' Jays. These are the fatuous Poppin' Jays. They squawk and squawk. It hurts my ears. Last name Morgan. First name Pierce. Be creative. Find a way to insult somebody like Fatuous Poppin' Jays. So my question is, can I bid on an NFT that'll make that shit go away? No. I think it's going to be brilliant. And I am the muse. I am like Mona friggin' Lisa. That's who I am. Okay, Scott, one more quick break. We'll be back for wins and fails.
Yep.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
Okay, Scott, wins and fails. We are our own fail, apparently. We got a lot of feedback from listeners and how we missed the mark on our interview with Andrew
Duddums.
We did
miss it there. We really did miss it there.
We should have been tougher on him, on his company, Hims. I still think it's an interesting company, what it's been doing, and it could pivot into something else. But here is our resident doctor, Jeff Swisher, my brother and your biggest fan, Scott Galloway.
You have a brother that's a doctor? Who knew?
He likes attention himself. To tell us where we got.
I wonder where he got that.
Where he got it wrong.
Unlike his wilting flower sister.
Listen, professor of marketing, look at me. All right, let's listen to Jeff.
You know what? That's not fair. I've become much more self-actualized. Just this morning, Kara, a bee landed on me, and I thought, I'm not scared. I take it as a compliment that it mistook me for a flower.
That's what you are, a delicate flower. All right, let's listen to Dr. Jeff Swisher rip us a new one and then sew it back up because he's an excellent doctor. Go ahead, Jeff.
That's an image.
Hey, Kara and Scott. You guys know I love you both and I'm your biggest fan, but listen to me, as Kara says, as your actual big brother and Scott as your virtual one, you guys needed to do better with such a huge, complex, and promising topic as telehealth. This is such an important paradigm-shifting field that it's really important to get it right. Rather than a master of the universe, founder, CEO, personally, I would have invited somebody with a more global analytic view. Like, for instance, the extremely knowledgeable beat journalist Chrissy Farr, or the CIO of Kaiser Permanente, who's been at this game for a really long time, and they have been able to integrate virtual with in-person visits really quite well. Telemedicine has so much promise. It'll be awesome for pre-op screening and evaluation, some routine medical care, follow-up care, health promotion and wellness, but it's got to be done safely and intelligently as well as ethically. And it's got to work with doctors and other health professionals and not commodify us. It should ideally be an adjunct to physician-patient in-person interaction and not a replacement for it. Minor easily remedied problems with quick resolutions or the need for quick prescriptions, etc. It's such a small part of medicine. A lot of it is the experience and skill that a physician brings to the literal examining room table in an in-person interview and exam. There's so much more to say on this topic and so little time, but in general, you guys do great and I love listening to you. Thanks, be well. And maybe you guys can have me back as a guest on Pivot again and we can have a more substantive conversation on the subject of telehealth because there's a lot to be said about it.
There's my brother. Well, he's right. I feel bad.
I think we've been correctly shamed. I think he's been shamed. I think he nailed it. And by the way, since we did that interview a week ago, Hims is off 20% the stock.
Yeah.
I think that's largely because of Jeff Swisher or Dr. Swisher, but because Amazon's announced they're getting in. But
yes,
he's absolutely right. Direct to consumer ED drugs is not the same as offering.
No, but I think
advice.
I think one thing he fails, and I think doctors fail in general, is the experience with your doctor is broken. Everybody who has, I'm talking about general stuff. Like,
I think he gets that.
I think he gets that. And I don't think, but I don't think doctors do in general. They think the system is fine the way it is for patients. And I have to say, so much more innovation could go into this in health. It just doesn't. In much more complex stuff too. Not just.
I was thinking about your brother last
dysfunction.
Night.
Were you?
I was thinking about. I think anesthesiology is the brightest pulse of our species. Example.
You got to know everything. You got to keep people alive.
Well, if you think about it, our superpower as a species is cooperation that results in trust. We trust that people will pull over to the side of the road when they hear a siren. We trust them. We drop our kids off at school. They're not going to eat them. Our species, our superpower is cooperation that results in trust. And when you think about the ultimate example of our species' superpower, it's deciding to let a skilled professional take care of you while you are unconscious. And they will manage the netherland between consciousness and unconsciousness while people take pieces of you out of you.
Yeah.
And you trust that this person has your best interest at heart. You may not even know their name, but they're so skilled. They're so worried about your welfare. And we've created a system of capitalism and empathy and attracting nice, smart people.
Yep.
It really is kind of like it's the helm of the bobsled of what our,
you
makes
are correct.
Our species great.
I would agree with you 100%. It's a most difficult job. And I when it's done well, it's so great. I had a procedure. Jeff's not allowed to practice upon me because I'm his sister. But man, the people he picks, they put me right out. And then I woke right up. It was fantastic. I have to say, I didn't fear at all. And it's true. And you definitely can't do that online. You cannot give someone propofol.
What are your wins and fails, Kara?
I think that was enough.
That
was enough. There's plenty to talk about this week. We will see the continued.
Well, I'm gonna win and fail.
I think Florida's failing in terms of that, and winning is the vaccinations continue apace. I think that is a win.
My fail is, there needs to be a statute of limitations. We need to let kids screw up in a safe place and learn from it. And their errors as children, we can't try them as adults. And what happened to Condé Nast, whether it's your point that Condé Nast screwed up here, we just need to be mindful that there's a difference between actions at 17 and actions at 27.
This is true, but I'm gonna
preface here we go.
That.
No, my go fails ahead. Get my fails are unedited, Kara. I don't know if you got the memo from our producer.
All right, then my fail. Here's my fail. I'm gonna have my fail then. My fail is that we do not take into account consequences of our actions and then try to act like we're a victim. When we do bad things, we should pay for them.
Is she
That's
acting
it.
Like she's a victim?
Thank you. No, not her.
What
I'm
are
just
you
saying.
Talking about?
I'm not talking about this particular instance, but a lot of this cancel culture bullshit, like the Andrew Cuomo pulling it. Stop like pawing women, sir.
You're conflating
Stop killing.
Totally different
I
issues.
I am conflating, but people like dump it in the same thing, like fake news. People dump it into the same
pot. The two are totally different.
They
I'll give
are,
you that.
But people don't do that. Cancel culture has become a thing, like fake news has become a thing. And it's very, there is some fake news. It's just not all of it. And they tend to use it as a
okay,
cudgel.
Holding people to a standard you do not want to hold your own children to. Let me just put it
yeah,
that way.
No, I got that. I
okay,
got
so
that.
A win.
I like that you're
rather than
the
grandstanding. Rather than the grandstanding of Senators Sanders and Warren, there are senators and elected leaders just doing the hard work.
Yeah.
And so my wins are Representative Cicilline, Senators Bennett, who's been pushing the earned income tax credit for children for years and didn't get any credit for it when it got into the bill in a huge size. Do you realize that people under the age of the households with income less than $50,000 are going to see their income increase 20% this year. That is a huge win for us, and it's overdue. Yeah. It is a form of UBI, which I'm not entirely sure I agree with, but I think it's a worthwhile experiment. We needed to level up this group, and also Senator Klobuchar, who, again, rather than posing for the cameras, is doing the hard work around antitrust. So those are my wins. Good government.
Nice. You know who my win is?
Go ahead.
Dr. Jeffrey Swisher.
I knew you were going to say that.
All the Swishers. Swishers in general. Thank
there you.
You
go.
There you go. Okay, Scott. That's the show. It's a little testy today. I like it. I like a little testy.
Spicy.
A
little spicy.
A little testy.
A little spicy. Anyway, a little salt around the room of that pivot margarita.
We'll be back Friday for more as soon as we sign up for Trump's social network, and we'll be back.
And it's like a shot of tequila. You don't really feel it until you walk away from the table.
That
so in about 30
true.
Minutes, you're going to think, I wish I'd been nicer to the dog.
That's true. I'd be nicer. Someone just sent me a new bottle of tequila, so I will do that. I will drink before every show. Anyway, go to nymag.com/pivot to submit your question for a Pivot podcast. The link is also in our show notes. Scott, read us out.
Today's show was produced by Rebecca Sinanis. Ernie Indratot engineered this episode. Thanks also to Hannah Rosen and Drew Burrows. Make sure you subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, or if you're an Android user, check us out on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening to Pivot from New York Magazine and Vox Media. We'll be back later this week for another breakdown of all things tech and business. The wonderful thing about our society and our species is that incredibly impressive people opt for teaching, not money. Thank you, Professor David Yermak. And can be trusted when we are totally helpless. Thank you, Dr. Swisher.